Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Mark Gamza, who's Associate Professor of History in the Department of East Asian Studies at Tel Aviv University, and he'll be talking about his new book, Manchuria, A Concise History, which is being published this year, 2020, by Bloomsbury. For many people with even a passing interest in East Asia's past or present, Manchuria seems to retain a particular allure. What is this curious part of China that seems to have its own name? Is it even okay to refer to it as Manchuria anymore? Who were the Manchus, or who are the Manchus? And why is it that we also associate this place with Russia, Japan, Korea, not to mention the indigenous people who lived there before any of these states really turned up? Up to now, and somewhat surprisingly, there haven't been many obvious places to look for answers to these questions, and so Mark Gamza's Manchuria, A Concise History is therefore a much-needed work. Tackling the many interwoven strands of this region's experiences of empire and revolution, migration and modernism, Gamza draws on a decades of regional expertise to craft a highly readable and easily digestible account of this fascinating place. Conveniently broken down into well-targeted chunks which move us from one key event or era of tumult to the next, the book brings together in one place lots of otherwise disparate information, as well as shedding light on many overlooked sides to Manchurian life, from Russian émigré literature to the immediate post-1945 years in the region and the role of the Mongols in northeastern Chinese affairs. All this feeds into an account which throughout considers the relative merits of studying Manchuria as an entity at all, though the consistently fascinating tales that Gamza tells us here speak for themselves, I think, in justifying the exercise. But the author himself is here to tell us some of these tales, and so I'll say, Mark Gamza, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Well, thank you for coming on. Before we get into kind of the depths of, I guess, Manchurian affairs over time, perhaps I could begin by asking you something about your background and so on. Your previous work has been a real kind of trove of insights for anyone interested in Northeast Asia or China-Russia matters and so on. So could you say something about how you got into this kind of world and these relationships?
Yeah. Well, I studied first at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, then in China and in Switzerland. And later I spent nearly 4 years in Britain, in Oxford, where I worked on my DPhil thesis at the Queen's College. And that thesis was on the history of Russian-Chinese contacts in Harbin. I had two supervisors at the time, the late Professor Glenn Dudbridge and Professor Gerald Smith in Oxford. I chose Harbin because when I spent a year in China, I went there and got quite hooked, if that's the word. So Harbin and more broadly Manchuria became my main subjects, although I did some work also on the translation of Russian literature in China, which had been the topic of my master's thesis at the Hebrew University, and some other forms of Russian-Chinese contacts.
I see. And so the languages, did you pick them up in the course of living in one or other country? I mean, how did the Russia kind of dimension come into things?
Well, Russian, fortunately, I never had to study, you know, because it's my native language. And as to Chinese, I have been studying it for many years. I started in Jerusalem and then spent also a year at the Inalco in Paris, a year in China, where I lived in Wuhu, a small town in the province. And then I continued to Geneva and to Oxford and went on studying Chinese all along, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty endless, I guess, a lifelong project, I think, for me.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Most recently, as I mentioned in the intro, you've been in Tel Aviv in Israel. Your project for this book, I believe, has some relationship to your current place there. So how did the actual book, Manchuria, A Concise History, come about?
Yes, it was actually written in the course of a seminar on Manchuria, which I taught in Tel Aviv for about 10 years or so, or even more. This idea I had was both to present this vast region and to place it in China and within its many international connections as well. Mm. So it was going on as a kind of manuscript in process until in 2017 at a conference, I met an editor of Tauris at the time, the London publisher, which is now part of Bloomsbury. And it turned out that a book like this fitted them. So I signed a contract for a manuscript of 70,000 words. And then this book eventually joined the Bloomsbury list in politics and international relations, which rather explains the emphasis on these aspects in the book. Mm-hmm. Actually, I see that in 2019, they published also Michael Dillon's A Political History of Mongolia, which is a book of about the same length as mine. And now I notice that in March 2020, a book by Rebecca Haynes, Moldova, A History, is coming out. So with this Manchuria, Mongolia, and Moldova, I suspect that they have a predilection for the letter M. But more seriously, I wanted sort of to put before the student or the general reader who has no prior knowledge of Manchuria a coherent introduction. And I thought that a book of this kind should draw on the available literature in English. And so I've largely resisted the temptation to send readers to sources in Russian or Chinese. Mm-hmm. And also for someone who likes going into very minute details, it has been an interesting challenge to make a book for a change from a bird's eye view. And this is a very different project.
Well, yeah, and I think it does that job extremely well. There's no point at which I think one feels too dragged into the, into the thick forests of southern Manchuria or the alienation of the northern plains or anything like that. So I think, it's a great work in that regard. But that leads us pretty naturally into talking about the book and indeed in general Manchuria as a region, if we're calling it that indeed. So our listeners will obviously know something of the kind of history of the region, perhaps, or the existence of the region. But could you give us a picture of your own perspective on Manchuria, how you conceive of it, how big is this area that you're terming in the book Manchuria? And what are the issues around even calling it Manchuria?
Well, as to the size, you know, Owen Latimore, the famous scholar of Manchuria and Mongolia, described Manchuria as France and Spain combined. And that gives already a fairly good idea of the size. And now it's about 10% of the PRC today in terms of territory. The historical definition of Manchuria within the Chinese borders, because some people actually speak of the Greater Manchuria, which would then include also the Russian Far East. But within the Chinese borders, then we are speaking of the three provinces of the northeast, which are Heilongjiang, Jilin, and Liaoning. The northeastern part of Inner Mongolia, and the city of Chengde, north of Beijing. So that's the territorial definition. As to the place name, it's a very peculiar place name, actually, because it was used by foreigners, first by the missionaries, then by the Japanese, but not by the Chinese. It remains a standard usage in a Western historical reference to this region until the mid-20th century. Thereafter, I think that one should use the Northeast. So as soon as you speak of the period after 1949, the establishment of the PRC. And indeed, if this book is ever translated into Chinese, the title should then become Dongbei. And not Manchuria.
And could you give us a sense of what the reasons are for that change in terminology? I mean, what are the political or historical reasons that you wouldn't call it Manchuria after 1949?
Yes. Well, for the Chinese, speaking of Manchuria at the moment makes no sense, because the only association that it creates is with the Manchukuo state. And when the Chinese do speak of the Manchukuo state, created by the Japanese from 1932 to 1945, they add the character Wei of false or puppet to it, to make it entirely clear that it was not a real country. So in that sense, the use of Manchuria in China is pretty sensitive. And I'm limiting it to the historical period in which it was known by this name, as I say, by foreigners in all the languages, other than Chinese itself.
Right. And that makes sense. And so why is it that you think this region deserves particular attention within our general consideration of China and East Asia at large?
Well, for many reasons, because of its sheer size, which I mentioned, its close connection to the last dynasty, the Qing dynasty, and because of it being a border region with a particularly turbulent history, which I think comes across in the book, and because of a certain shared trans-provincial identity. So across these three provinces today, people do feel that they belong to this region, which they call Dongbei. So that too makes it possible to study it as a whole, even at the present time when we no longer call it by the name Manchuria.
Now that does make sense. And I guess the sort of, as we get into talking about the content of the book and the history of the area, it also becomes clear that the importance of the region also lies in the fact that so many different groups of people and so many different important events, I guess, have happened in this one place or across this one place, if we're calling it one place, despite its massive size. But as you take us into the book then in part one, it's a two-part book, essentially divided between a historical kind of succession of chapters, 15 in all, running from, I guess, the earliest time of particularly a Manchu presence or Manchu rise in Manchuria up to the Mao era and even a bit beyond. And then a second part, which deals with each region of Manchuria or of Dongbei, province by province, as well as discussing a little bit some of the contemporary historiography of the region. So at the beginning of part one, we discuss the kind of ethnic makeup, if you like, at the very kind of, some of the earlier indigenous inhabitants that I mentioned in the intro. So who were the people living in Manchuria, and indeed many of them are still living there, it should be said, who are not necessarily people we would immediately called Chinese or let alone Russian or Japanese?
Well, this is really the question that comes to mind when you think of the natives of this region, in the sense the people native to it, who considered the Manchuria their natural home, even though they never called it like that. They didn't use this name, Manchuria. Well, certainly the Manchus, though their own relations with this region is again very complicated, in the sense that most of them left it already in the 17th century after the conquest of China. But still it was considered as this ancestral land of the Manchu people. And then really those native peoples, these indigenous groups that you mentioned, the Elunchun, for example, in Heilongjiang, or the Heje, on which you yourself have done some work. These are groups that hardly ever figure in any historical account of Manchuria, with the exception, I should really say, of the wonderful book by Professor Jan Hunen of Helsinki University called Manchuria, an Ethnic Portrait. There you can find wonderful chapters on the culture and the language of these peoples. So I tried to include them in the book, however briefly, just to make sure that the readers know that they were there and the kind of life that they led and their situation, quite a precarious one, between those two empires, the Russian and the Chinese, since they lived on both sides of the two great rivers, which became the borders between the two countries after 1860, the Heilongjiang or the Amur and the Ussuri.
But it's not quite so easy to separate in many ways, I guess, the Manchus per se from some of these groups, because the way that the idea of the Manchus as a people came about was something that was that rested on, I guess, some of these indigenous foundations, perhaps it's fair to say. So how was it that this idea of the Manchus, I guess, came into being? And what sort of status did Manchuria obtain under the Qing dynasty, which you've already mentioned, the last dynasty founded by Manchu people?
Well, they do come from this region, and they were closely connected with these indigenous groups that I mentioned before. But they rose as the most powerful force in Manchuria in the late 16th century. They initially identified with the Jurchens, who had established the Jin dynasty in the 12th century. But then in the 1630s, something very unusual happens. Their military leader, a man called in Chinese Hong Taiji, decides to abandon this historical association with the Jurchens, and now he decrees that his people are going to be called Manchus from now on. And the meaning of that name is actually still being debated. There are several versions about what Manchu actually means. Now, the story of the Manchu banners, which many Han Chinese people also joined, is a story that's quite well known to everybody who studies China. But then what happens with the Manchuria after the conquest of China? After 1644 is another story, and that's a far less familiar one, because historians of the Qing naturally focus on the court in Beijing and much less on Manchuria itself. Now, from the late 17th century to about the 1870s, so for nearly two centuries, the Qing banned Han Chinese from settling in Manchuria. But this region was not really sealed off, in a sense that that ban existed in theory, but more in theory than in practice. And the Chinese constantly entered Manchuria secretly. And once the Qing actually adopted a new policy and started to encourage this migration from the 1870s, a whole human tide moved from North China to Manchuria and very soon created a Han Chinese majority in that region, which was very sparsely populated.
And I guess that brings us on perhaps to the next group of people we might talk about in this picture, because at least in part, if I'm right in thinking, the reason for relaxing any notional restrictions on migration had something to do with the appearance of Russia around this part of the world. It wasn't their first, I guess, foray into the Qing fringes, because that occurred back in the 17th century. Could you give us a picture of the kind of story of Russian in contact with the Qing from those early sort of skirmishes in the 17th century, and how then that evolved over the ensuing decades and indeed centuries up to the 19th century?
Right. Well, it's a long story. Russia arrives in this region because it continues this expansion into Siberia, which it had started in the mid 16th century. And so eventually the Russian forces reach the Amur River, and there they meet the Qing, and they are rebuffed by the Qing army. And the result of that is the famous Treaty of Nerchinsk in 1689, which is the first diplomatic treaty China ever signed. And so that fixed the border far to the north than the border that we know now. The border then, according to this Treaty of Nerchinsk, was along the Stanovoy mountain range. And this was an arrangement that lasted for a very long time until the mid-19th century. But then at that period, China is very weak. And during the Arrow War, 1858 to 1860, the Qing dynasty cannot protect those borders any longer. And therefore, Russia, by basically negotiations without firing a shot, is able to annex these territories to the north of the Amur River, and then also to the east of the Ussuri River. And that created the borders which we still have today on the maps, and the region that we now call the Russian Far East. Then the Russians expanded further into Manchuria itself, because that was connected to the huge engineering project of the late Tsarist era, the construction of the Trans-Siberian Railway. And they decided to build the last leg of that railway by crossing into Chinese territory. So through Manchuria, which would shorten the way. And negotiations with the Qing again led to the conclusion of a contract, an agreement on that, and they started building this railway called the Chinese Eastern Railway, completing it in 1903. And that was the direct reason for the construction of the city of Harbin, which was founded in 1898 as the headquarters of this railway. Then there's a twist in the plot, because after 1917, of course, the former colonists in Manchuria become emigres. So those Russians now live there in a very different situation than the one that they had before the revolution, when they were backed by the Tsarist Empire. And then these people are being joined in the 1920s by refugees from Soviet Russia and especially Siberia. And the story goes on. You see, in 1925, the Soviet Union signs an agreement with China to manage this railway together. And from that point on, only citizens of those two countries can actually work on the railway, and the railways have no place in it.
Right.
Well, it's a story that I try to tell in that book rather in brief, but it's the main focus on my other book, which is coming out later this year.
Got it. Well, we'll perhaps
the
get
book
on to
Harbin.
That. Right. And we can maybe talk about that shortly. But kind of in this picture of, I guess, constantly shifting authorities and power centers with some degree of control over Manchuria as a whole, but the China Eastern Railway is a pretty good stand-in for what's going on as the Russian Empire collapses and turns into the Soviet Union, and as also the Qing dynasty comes to its end and the Republic of China is founded and so on. And into this sort of mix of competing authorities over Manchuria comes another major power as the Qing wanes, namely Japan. And so I guess Japan serves as both China and Russia's main rival for influence for a period. Why was it that Japan and Tokyo became interested in Manchuria, and how did its projects in the region, including the state of Manchukuo that you mentioned, which creates such sensitivity today around using Manchuria, how did these kinds of projects evolve over time?
Well, Japan first gained a foothold in Manchuria after winning the war with China over the control of Korea. That's 1895. They occupied then the Liaodong Peninsula, but were very soon forced to return it to China because of pressure from the European powers. And so from then on, southern Manchuria is a prize that Japan feels that it needs to regain. And that's pretty much the background of the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905, at the end of which Japan does manage to get southern Manchuria as a region where it builds the Southern Manchuria Railway. It takes hold of the city of Dalian, which the Japanese called Dairen, a city founded by the Russians as well. And then, of course, in 1931 comes this local initiative of the Japanese army in that region, the Kwantung Army, leading to a military conquest of this whole territory and the creation of the state of Manchukuo in the following year in 1932. And so from 1932 to 1945, we have this so-called country, which is actually headed by the last emperor of the Qing dynasty, Puyi. Mm-hmm. It breaks down, collapses in 1945 at the end of the war. It does leave many traces, both physical traces. If you think of a place like Changchun, today the capital of Jilin, that was the capital of the state of Manchukuo, where they built many new streets and buildings. In Dalian, of course, as well, you can see the legacy of the Japanese there, and in the large industrial complexes which they built and left behind then in Manchuria. And then apart from this tangible legacy, there's also the memory of the Japanese rule, which was a very brutal one. In the Mao area, in the Mao era, these memories were rather suppressed, but then from the mid-1980s, the state actually begins to encourage the survivors to tell their stories, and the museums are being built. And especially one focuses on the notorious unit 731, which I mentioned in the book, which conducted biological experiments on humans in Manchuria. And so because of this, this very strong emphasis on the brutality of the Japanese rule, the Manchuk War period, quite a long one actually, 13 years, is being painted in the darkest colors. And yet, I think there was also room for normal daily life in those years, which hasn't been studied enough. And another large issue here is the question of resistance versus collaboration and all the gray area in between, something which I also try to touch on in the book.
And I mean, this may kind of touch on the Harbin question as well that you mentioned is the subject of a separate book. But I just wonder, and it's a story that is also not often told, but how did the Russians fare in Manchukuo, I mean, within this Japanese-run state? What was their sort of fate, having already, you know, been severed from former Tsarist realm that had collapsed, you know, while they were in Manchuria and they became émigrés, as you said? What did they get up to under Japanese rule?
Mm-hmm. Well, in 1935, the Soviet Union sold the railway to Manchukuo, thereby actually recognizing it, which not many countries did. And from then on, the remaining Russians in Manchuria were a small minority, which had to make many compromises in order to get along with the Japanese rulers. There was a large movement of repatriation to the Soviet Union immediately after the sale of the railway in 1935. Ended in a tragedy because most of these people were then exterminated in the Stalinist purges of 1937, the suspected spies for Japan or whatever. And the remaining Russians stayed in Manchuria until the 1950s. And they left it then because after the establishment of the PRC, it was entirely clear that they had no place there anymore. The last of them remained until the 1960s. And from then on, there were, maybe a dozen survivors of this community in Harbin, which at its peak may have counted around a quarter of a million people.
Wow. Kind of set of chapters of history that I think are not so well known, but which you've dedicated part of your career to shedding some light on. So that's great. But as far as what happened to this railway, again, if we return to the China Eastern Railway, once the Japanese colonial era had ended in 1945, and I guess arguably the Soviet Union could step back in if it wanted to and kind of exert influence once again. The People's Republic of China was not yet founded. So what happened in those kind of immediate post-war years after 1945? And then how did the Soviet Union kind of interact with the PRC over some of these Manchurian interests that it had? I mean, there's obviously a degree of complication around a socialist country with another socialist country next to it. Asserting some kind of almost imperial interest over a region.
Yes. Well, as for the attitude of the Soviet Union towards the Russians in Manchuria, those Russians who did not take a Soviet citizenship and who remained émigrés were considered enemies of Russia. You know, they were called the white bandits, and by many other names. And so the attitude towards them by the Soviet state was highly negative. They were not likely to protect them from the Chinese or the Japanese or indeed from anybody else. Then the presence of the Soviet Union in Manchuria is a very important one because the Soviet Union in the summer of 1945 invades Manchuria with a huge army, defeats the Japanese there. These are actually the last battles of the Second World War, and establishes a control over Manchuria for about a year. So 45 to 46. Then the Soviet army leaves it, but as you rightly point out, the 1950s are a period of this very close connection between the two states. It was the decade of the great friendship of the Soviet Union and communist China, and Soviet specialists, experts, arrive in Manchuria, as they do also in many other parts of China, and they help the Chinese in many fields, in particular to develop these industrial complexes that were left from the Japanese period, huge factories of and mines, of course. And the Soviet Union helps in developing these. It should also be mentioned that the Soviets had taken home from Manchuria many parts of the equipment and so on of these factories as a war booty, yes, in 45 already. But then in the 50s, they do help the Chinese to develop them further. And there is a new community of Soviets who lives in the large cities of Manchuria during that period. And of course, it all ends towards 1959, 1960, with the large rift between the two great communist states. And from then on, Russia is the enemy number one. Mm-hmm. And the Soviet Union is being denounced. And that's, again, a whole new chapter in Manchuria as well.
Sure. Well, and it may be the first chapter in this sort of long saga of inter-country and inter-polity contacts across this region, that the region is definitively Chinese, if you like. It's part of the PRC and for the first time doesn't have large numbers of, you know, other people, if we're looking from a Chinese perspective, which we may not always, but if at least we're looking from Beijing, there are not then all these other people meddling in the region for the first time, if you like, in the 60s. But given all of these sort of tumultuous, interlocking, crisscrossing events and imperial projects and socialist projects and so on, it may seem quite surprising that the region did end up as part of China rather than as part of any other political body, or indeed perhaps even as an independent one. So what is it that you think ensured that that was the case? How is it that we still talk of this region? I mean, we don't just talk of it. It is a part of China rather than anywhere else. And was it migration, for example, that you highlighted earlier of Han people that mainly saw to that, or are there other reasons?
Well, yes, absolutely. In terms of the social history of the region and the demography, it is entirely clear that the Manchuria becomes Chinese by the beginning of the 20th century. And certainly the migration of Chinese from Shandong and from Hebei provinces, which is estimated at about 30 million people or more, has entirely changed the makeup of this region, both demographically and culturally, and in terms of the languages being spoken there as well. It is considered one of the largest migrations in world history as a whole.
Mm. And that's the kind of main force, do you think, that keeps this as a part of the Chinese world?
Yes, and then you have to bear in mind as well that in the 1950s, in view of all these large industrial projects, the Mao regime sends more people into Manchuria from China. So they are the pre-communist period settlers, and they are the post-1950s one. And mm-hmm. they together have changed this region entirely. They have indeed made it Chinese in every sense.
And I guess it's some of these kind of later Maoist campaigns. I'm thinking of the Great Northern Wilderness or the Bei Da Huang campaign to kind of claim or reclaim unfarmed land and so on. I guess that, yeah, it does lock this place in and give it a very distinctive role within the more contemporary history of the People's Republic. So I guess that kind of gives us a pretty good sense of the broad sweep of the history of the area from those kind of early Manchu days, perhaps, up to the more contemporary era. Moving into part two of the book, you, as I mentioned earlier, give us a kind of province by province breakdown, which I think is extremely helpful in its own right, just for, you know, seeing in English the history and geography of Jilin, or Liaoning, or Heilongjiang, these three kind of northeastern provinces, as well as the Mongolian element. So could I just ask you, kind of related to that, why was it that you felt it would be a good idea to break things up in this way and give pictures of these three provinces in their own right, since, as you say, they're often identified together as part of the Northeast?
Yes. Well, generally, there's been hardly any research, or maybe I should say too little research, on the Chinese provinces. And speaking of Manchuria specifically, there are two or three books in English that are specifically devoted to Heilongjiang, only two or three. There is no monograph on Jilin province. There is, though, a book on Changchun by Bill Sewell that came out in 2018. And there is no book at all on Liaoning. So in that sense, the second part of my book, which devotes separate chapters to these provinces, as well as to the Mongols in Manchuria and to Changde, well, it's a very modest contribution towards remedying that situation in which there is so little in English that you read about these regions.
And why is it, do you think, that we need to understand these sort of separate provinces distinctively?
Well, to put it very simply, because China is huge, you know. And we often speak in these generalizations about China and the Chinese, and it's fine. But as soon as you travel in China, for example, you do notice the local identities, the importance of the local place, the dialects too. And therefore, it is, I think, very important to get to, well, a lower scale when dealing with a region, and to try to get, well, their maps of the provinces in the book, you know, to get a grip on that, on the local picture as well, and not just on the bird's eye view, as I put it before.
Sure, and yeah, all the more so in an area which is generalized as Dongbei today, just as it was generalized as Manchuria in the past. I mean, I think very noticeably, you know, I've spent a period living in Jilin, for example, and Jilin people definitely have plenty of their opinions about what Heilongjiang people are like and why we don't want all these Heilongjiang types wandering around, and even non-Han groups that live in these different provinces. I mean, Koreans, for example, in Jilin, in Yanbian, the Korean autonomous area there, will distinguish very readily between themselves and the Heilongjiang Koreans. And I should say the Koreans is a group that we haven't discussed much at length here, but they're also a key kind of people within the picture of the Northeast. But just to kind of wrap up in terms of our view of the Northeast as a whole, the other subject you touch on in this second part of the book is New Qing history, a field of historical study of the Qing dynasty, which has gained a lot of attention in recent last couple of decades, I suppose, in particular. What do you think it is that New Qing history has contributed to our understanding of this region and the role that it and its people have played in China's recent past?
Well, I certainly think that there's a lot of merit in studying the Qing as an empire which enlarged and redefined China And especially if the alternative to this is just seeing the current borders of the PRC as something natural and self-evident. No borders are. The other thesis of the new Qing studies is the focus on the Manchus and on their sense of distinctiveness within China. And this undermines the famous narrative of the Sinicization of the Manchus, which I think is a very useful thing as well. And in my own research on Harbin, I've certainly seen that the influence went in both directions. Although the Manchus did lose their language and they were clearly influenced by the Han in many ways, there were also Manchu influences on the Han population in Manchuria.
Interesting. But this is obviously also a field of study which has kind of, I guess, drawn a degree of controversy in China itself. What is it that the Chinese authorities don't like about New Qing history, do you think? I mean, maybe that's putting it a bit bluntly, but there do seem to be some objections. Why is it that do you think this doesn't appeal to them?
Well, I think the most thorny question here is the matter of the borders. As soon as you acknowledge that these borders are the result of particular historical developments, that they were contingent on them, and they are not the natural borders of China and the Chinese nation, that clashes with the narrative that is now being taught in the PRC schools. And then, of course, China has very much tried to Sinicize the Manchus in every sense, making them just another Chinese dynasty, which current research actually shows that was not exactly the case. The Manchus did not just one bright day start to think of themselves as Chinese. They did retain certain parts of an identity that was particular to them. And this research certainly has brought out those aspects.
No, absolutely right. And I think, although not necessarily or not really a work of that particular historical strand itself, I think this book also contributes very well to revealing the contingencies and the non-automatic nature of borders and of indeed the people who live in certain areas. I think Manchuria as a whole is somewhere that exposes lots of these things extremely well. So thank you very much for talking to us about it today. Before we actually let you go, having taken up a fair chunk of your time, I thought I'd ask you, Mark, what is it that you're currently working on? You mentioned this Harbin book. Would you like to talk a bit more about that or other kinds of projects that you have on the go?
Well, the Harbin book has been a particularly long project, and I'm very glad it's now finally over, and the book is expected to come out from University of Toronto Press in about November or December this year. And then I've started working on another project, which will be on gold mining. The history of gold mining across the borders of the Russian Far East and Manchuria between the 1880s and the 1920s. And so far, the title for it that I have in mind is The Forgotten Gold Rush. Mm. But we'll see how it develops.
Fantastic. Well, no, I think that'll be another great illumination of the the life of and the history of this region, which you've already shed so much valuable light on from the points of view of history and literature and culture and all the rest. So sounds great. And we'll look forward to reading it, I'm sure. In any case, though, Mark, thank you so much again today for being on the show. It was wonderful talking to you.
Thank you very much, Ed. It was a pleasure.
Listeners, thank you too for listening, as ever, to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and it will be back with you again very soon. Goodbye.